Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm very happy to be talking to Zachary Mason, the author of The Lost Books of the Odyssey, a collection of intertwined stories inspired by Homer's epic poem. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. The Odyssey is about a hero's attempts to return home at the end of the Trojan War. The gods have cursed Odysseus, so the reunion with his wife Penelope is thwarted and interrupted. A sorceress attempts to enchant him, a princess tries to seduce him, the giant one-eyed Cyclops entraps him. Zachary Mason's wonderful new book breaks the 10-year voyage home into its component stories and gives us the opportunity to recombine and reimagine what happens from many perspectives, sort of like twisting a narrative Rubik's Cube until what we assemble is the Lost Books of the Odyssey. Tell me, you don't come from the writing programs and the normal roots of literature. Tell me how this book began. How did you begin to write it?
That's a good question. So I've never really had a writing class except for one when I was 11 years old. My background is in math and physics, and I did a PhD in computer science. But I've been writing on my own since I was about 19 years old. And for 10 years or so, I didn't tell anybody about it. And I didn't complete anything substantial, just sort of fragments of short stories and the like. And eventually I decided that if I was going to be serious, I needed to do a book. So I looked through my many hundreds of pages of notes, and I found some fragments that I liked, and I collected them. And the shape of the Lost Books was sort of implicit in them. In any case, the seed of the shape of the Lost Books was implicit.
Wow. The result is The Lost Books of the Odyssey by my guest Zachary Mason, and it takes shape from the idea that what we know as Homer's Odyssey and the Iliad as well is only a part of the story, because after all, it was the oral tradition. Homer comes at the climax of a whole world of improvising bards telling these stories, and one is to assume, although we haven't heard them, many bards follow Homer. Not just speaking bards, but we've got odysseys from, among others, poets like Cavafy and Tennyson and, Kazantzakis, that what the Odyssey implies is a whole world of variants and possibilities, many of which we haven't heard before, some of which we have, which are told in interrelated and often very small stories. Fragments come naturally to this form.
Yeah, there's certainly a recent tradition of rewriting Homer. And given the way oral traditions work, this is where the story came from. Whether or not there was a historical Homer, with orally transmitted stories, they keep changing with every telling. So it's more like the aesthetic of Homer evolved probably over centuries in these tellings and retellings. So I feel like I've tapped into both a recent and an ancient tradition.
Now, everyone has reviewed and written about this book. Most people adore it. I've read articles all over the place, the New York Times, the New Yorker, but I felt as I was reading it as if the critics were not writing about the book the author wrote, at least as he thought of it. Now, of course, I accept the fact that there are many, many, many interpretations, but here on Bookworm, we want to hear what the author has to say. And it struck me that this book, The Lost Books of the Odyssey, is a book with a kind of dazzling buried structure that a reader doesn't need to know it, but you can feel the integrity of the book below the surface. Something is holding it together.
I also feel like none of the reviews, as flattering as they are, really pin the book down. And I'm sympathetic to them because I can't pin it down either, really. At parties, I feel somewhat at a loss when somebody very naturally asks me to describe what I've spent the last 6 years working on. I think this difficulty is caused in part by the fact that the book is built around a number of patterns. So there are these various structures informing the book, and although all shape it, none of them define it entirely, which I think is one of the reasons it works. If the pattern is too clear-cut, it's banal. If there's no pattern, it's chaos. It's when there are these partial patterns that maybe you can distinguish that it's interesting. So in its original conception, the book was much more of Ulipo. Every chapter was to be no more than a page, and I was concocting some fairly rigid combinatoric rules based around islands. So each combination of elements would define an island and how it was to be entered and how it was to be left and the sort of emotional constraints on what would come to pass on that island. And you can still see that in places, but I certainly had to relax that constraint. Length, obviously, there are chapters that go on as long as 20 pages, I think. There were also various styles I was working with. So there are some chapters that are sort of written in an imaginative variation on the style of the Arabian Nights.
We often think when we read a book like the Iliad that it must be implicitly anti-war, but a good deal of Greek literature celebrates war, as does a good deal of the poetry in the Bible. That's talking about warfare, and to come to the understanding that Homer is a celebrator of the devastations that he describes, whereas Zachary Mason may not be. And so his Odysseus may be revealing the darker hand of the Trojan War.
So you're talking about the Iliad of Odysseus, right?
Yes.
Yes. So with that chapter, I was treating the Iliad and the Odyssey as a sort of distorted signal. So assuming there were real events and real human perspectives behind them, but they had been transmuted by the requirements of the epic poetry of the time. So I started wondering who Odysseus really would have been if there had been someone like Odysseus, and how he would have thought about the circumstances he found himself in. So I started thinking about how a very intelligent man who's not necessarily very athletic would feel if he were born into this Bronze Age aristocratic warrior society and surrounded by the equivalent of brainless, bloodthirsty jocks.
I'm talking to Zachary Mason about his book, The Lost Books of the Odyssey, and this is a book that's organized in 44 relatively short, intertwining sometimes stories about, well, the stories Homer told. Sometimes some of the friends in Greek literature make an appearance. There are other heroes who are mentioned and throw in their tales as well. But what's particularly beautiful, it seemed to me, about the book is that the language is very calm. The book has a real meditative surface. There's something very calm and timeless about the tone of the prose.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that. The way I approach prose is I want it to feel completely smooth. If it's imperfect, it feels kind of jagged to me. So my process is basically trying to smooth away all the anaphractuosities so that the prose almost vanishes. That's my goal, really, that it becomes invisible and you feel like you're just participating in the stream of thought and illusion.
Now, one of the reasons that I'm the reader I am is that Lewis Carroll wrote Alice in Wonderland. And like Queen Victoria, I wanted to read his other books. Mm-hmm. And when I got them, I found that they were mostly math books. Mm-hmm. But because they had interesting exercises mm-hmm. that sounded like Lewis Carroll, I taught myself math his way. Mm-hmm. And chess, mm-hmm. because Alice Through the Looking Glass is based on a chess game. Mm-hmm. And logic and everything else. And I think that one of the things that people hardly ever want to acknowledge is that mathematics, philosophy, technical philosophy, mm-hmm. and literature have a point of origin in common. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they do, mm-hmm. but they seem to. You mentioned the Ulipo earlier, and listeners to Bookworm know what the Ulipo is, but just in case you missed it, Ulipo is the name for a group of French mathematicians, chess players, philosophers, and writers who got together to see how you could make new structures for literature. And many mathematicians became interested, and chess masters. Duchamp was a great chess master and mathematician. Artists, writers, poets, mathematicians. Can you tell me, for you, what the linkage is?
Well, it's said that mathematics is the science of pattern, so anywhere there's pattern, there's mathematics. And literature is certainly composed of patterns, so in some sense, literature is a subdiscipline of mathematics. But math, as it's usually construed, is about these very simple, highly abstract patterns, and literature necessarily is hugely complex. It refers to the world and human experience and so on. So I'd say that the difference is really a matter of degree of complexity and abstraction. And what's interesting to me is how you can sometimes relate these two ends of the complexity spectrum and why that's so resonant. I mean, if it's a sterile exercise of, I don't know, structuring your novel mathematically, then that's not very exciting. But when it resonates, it really resonates.
You said you wanted the prose to be able to disappear into the last books of the Odyssey, Zach. But I think the mathematics disappears too. Mm. That's one of the pleasures.
Well, good. another sort of underlying pattern that I should have mentioned earlier was that although the chapters are nominally standalone, there are actually relationships between them. So one of the things you can do is assemble them in various chronological orders to make greater narratives, and they refer to each other more subtly as well. There's one where Odysseus becomes a bard and starts making up stories, and the stories he's making up are present in other chapters in the book, if you look at them carefully.
Yes, they contain one another, the tradition of the story within the story, mm-hmm. But which is also part here of the design, which is based upon the Greek key, which is, if you think about it, if you've been to a Greek diner and you've seen the placemat, it's usually around the border of the placemat or on the coffee cup or around the edges of a tapestry. It's an intersecting geometrical figure that folds in upon itself before it continues with its next leg of the figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for the first edition of the book, I designed the image that's on the cover and that you can find in a few places in the text. It's a fractal version of the Greek key. So it's a Greek key composed out of other Greek keys and so on to infinity in the fashion of fractals. It, no matter how deep you go, it looks the same. So making a complex self-referential mathematical structure out of an ancient Greek artistic motif. Seemed like an excellent representation for the book.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Zachary Mason, author most recently of The Lost Books of the Odyssey, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break, after which we'll find out what fractals are, or at least some of what fractals are, I promise. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Zachary Mason about his novel, The Lost Books of the Odyssey. This inventive reimagining of Homer's Odyssey is written as a series of interlocking short stories and vignettes, and what was unnoticed by the many admiring reviewers is that this book fits together in a somewhat puzzle-like fashion, which gives the reader the feeling of a building block structure, some of the building blocks of which fit like Russian dolls inside one another. I'm curious, as I understand it, didn't the discovery of fractals have to do in part with exploration, with people working on the shape of coastlines, if I remember correctly?
Oh, right. So, yes, fractals are quite useful for understanding any number of natural phenomenon. And it was observed that the length of a coastline depends on the size of the yardstick you use. So the bigger the yardstick, the bigger the little bumps that you're going to miss when you apply it are going to be. So, for instance, Spain's measurement of the coastline of Portugal is smaller than Portugal's measure of its own coastline, insofar as Spain being bigger uses a bigger yardstick.
That's interesting. And isn't it the case then also that when you look at a coastline, that at a certain point, as you break it down incrementally, you will find a certain point at which, however irregular the coastline, repetition begins to enter, that the fractal reveals the symmetry where previously we thought mostly of dissymmetry and irregularity.
Well, with fractal-like structures in the natural world, you won't find exact repetition of forms, but you'll find the same general category of forms at many levels often. So, you know, the side of a ditch has essentially the same shape as a mountain range, really, and there are many intermediate levels where you'll find essentially that form.
What are some of the congruent forms in the book? Because I started to notice that, you know, there'll be places where I would say, I've been here before.
So one of the preoccupations with the book is the construction of the book, or if not the lost books, then the Odyssey. So some relatively large number of five, perhaps, versions of the writing of the Odyssey are given. So in one case, it's Odysseus who's finally managed to escape the life of a warrior and gone off to be a singer, which is what he always wanted to do. In another one, the Cyclops is more or less minding his own business on the island until some vagabonds show up and blind him, rob him, and leave him sitting there in the dark with nothing much to do except entertain revenge fantasies, which become ever more elaborate and eventually metamorphose into the Odyssey.
Oh, wow. So some of these stories are in fact, or not in fact, in possibility, the Cyclops fantasy about what should befall Odysseus.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great, because that intersects. Sometimes it's Helen or Calypso's curse on Odysseus going home, that he won't get home safely, not if they have anything to do with it.
Mm.
So we're talking about an intersection point of different characters projecting Ulysses' misfortune and then the bards singing of it retrospectively.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how thrilling.
I'm particularly partial to the Cyclops' account insofar as, well, you can have any number of gods and goddesses curse Odysseus or interfere, but the length and complexity of his tribulations and how he keeps almost coming home and coming within sight of Ithaca's shores and then being pulled away seems a lot like somebody really wants to hurt him imaginatively but doesn't quite want to let go and finish the job. and I mean, Homer was blind and the Cyclops is blinded, and it seems entirely psychologically plausible that if somebody came and stabbed out your eyes, you would be obsessed with them. So I felt like this was almost there in the text, and I just had to give it a little bit of a push, and it came together.
Oh, wow. So this sort of opens like a flower.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as you can read the book on its surface, which is plenty interesting and, to my mind, meditative and placid. I enjoyed reading a book that had such, I don't know, a kind of trance structure. And like trance music, you can get lost in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very pleasant, and its interest is in various concisions within the chapters. They're very carefully written small. Mm-hmm. But once you put them together, they form chains. Am I getting this right?
They form lots of little chains. It's kind of like chopping up some DNA and then letting it rebond with itself. You'll get lots of little ones, even if it doesn't form an entire complete structure. And they refer to each other in different ways, so there are different kinds of relationships.
Cassandra is one of the places within the stories. The stories refer to her, but we put her story together piece by piece, yes?
Well, there's a chapter about Cassandra, and she's referenced in a few places. So, yes, you can infer her narrative through line.
So she is, in a sense, she's a seeress. She's a prophetess. She's foretelling the thing that Homer is telling in the past. So she's predicting in the future the thing that Homer will discover is the history of the past, yes?
Yes, but I engaged with her in a somewhat different way.
Tell me.
So, actually, the Cassandra chapter is one of the ones where you can see the meta-mathematical skeleton behind the book. So, Cassandra knew the future, but because the gods were angry with her, it was her fate never to be believed. So she tried to warn her father and her brothers that Troy was going to fall and they were going to die, and their families be slaughtered and enslaved and so on, but no one believed her. And, of course, she also knew her own fate, which was to be a slave in a distant country. But she thought she could tell by secret signs and portents that, in fact, for once, the god was wrong and that she would be fine, which is, of course, nothing more than the fulfillment of her curse and her power.
One of the most thrilling, to me, stories inside your book, The Lost Books of the Odyssey, by my guest, Thackeray Mason, is a story that as Odysseus thinks he's going home, finally, he discovers that he's on a ship going back to the war he thought he just left.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrative wants to move backward toward home,
mm-hmm.
but in fact, it's intersecting with a narrative moving forward toward war, toward Troy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very partial to that one. So Odysseus destroys Troy with the Trojan horse, and he's heading home. He gets lost. The usual disasters happen. And then when he's lost at sea, he gets picked up by a ship, which is his old comrades, rather younger than he'd last seen them, going off to war. And they think he's a deserter. He tried to escape impressment at the beginning of the war. So he's locked below decks, and there he finds a copy of the Iliad. And it's not just the Iliad, but there's a sort of midrash on it. And it explains how the Iliad is a sort of essential archetype, and that there have in fact been many Trojan Wars, and they represent a sort of evolving aesthetic, and how sometimes characters in the story find the book, but it doesn't really matter, because Agamemnon doesn't believe anything he reads, and Achilles just flips through it and shrugs, and Priam makes sacrifices to the indifferent gods. And if there ever were characters who were moved by it, they're long gone. And Odysseus ends up being one of them. He finds Helen, and although everything has been repeating itself exactly as it was the first pass through, something is different with her, so they manage to abscond. So it sort of imagines the Iliad as a vortex going around and around, repeating the same events, and trying to find a consistent state, and any elements of the story that are going to cause new things to emerge on subsequent passes get ejected.
Now, at the beginning, you were saying that many people regard mathematics as simple and literature as complex. But I think most readers regard literature as simple and mathematics as complex. Here in this vortex, we find this interesting mixture of the two. Simplicity and complexity. Simplicity of telling joined by complexity of structure of what could be many readings, subsequently revealed structure. And that's what I found very exciting about the book.
As far as math being hard, even though it's simple, and literature being easy, even though it's complex, I'd say that our minds are designed to understand the physical world and social relationships and the like, and very abstract things, even though they're simpler in some formal sense, require a great deal of more effort, which has actually been one of the sticking points for progress in artificial intelligence, which is my other job. Traditionally, engineers have thought, well, what's intelligence? It's things that I think are challenging, such as playing chess and proving theorems. But it turns out that for computers, it's very easy to do those things. But walking across a room or understanding a conversation or parsing some scene in different lighting conditions is unimaginably complicated.
Wow. So that the artificial is the natural and vice versa.
Yep.
Oh, how lovely. I've been talking with Zachary Mason, author most recently of The Lost Books of the Odyssey, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Zachary, for joining me.
My pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Lost Books of the Odyssey at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.